I'm super happy to be here today again with Ryan. Hi, Ryan.
Hey.
We are going to continue the conversation about AI that I started recently with Michael, and maybe look a little bit again at this whole idea of whether language is similar to AI in that both are auto-generative and auto-regressive. But I want to break it down more in terms of art and psychology and not look so much at the theory of what AI is, but actually look at what might be the differences between human language and AI language. So, Ryan, your background is in coding, but since you were a coder, you have gone on and gotten a master's degree in psychology. Is that correct?
Well, counseling, yeah.
A
I just
master's degree in
graduated,
counseling.
yeah. But it touched on a lot of all the,
Right.
kind
In
of
order to do that,
history.
you had to look at human psychology.
Yeah.
So, one of the difficulties for me when I'm trying to wrap my head around these ideas is oftentimes they start talking about the hardware software distinction. And maybe I can give you an example of how why this is confusing to me sometimes. Here is a comment that was made on the can you see this screen with comments on it?
Yes, I can.
Okay. This is a comment that was made by Glenn Wild Iris Discovery here, this big W here. He says, while Karen echoes of some of our old conversations, Elon's ideas are more useful if you're trying to understand how language is processed at a hardware level within the brain. On the other hand, his ideas seem to miss the mark when you're trying to use them to understand how we use language in communication. These are two different processes that have to run at the same time when we think, talk, and/or write. Approaching these two facets separately would open the way to deeper rabbit holes to go down. So maybe you could help me understand what is the hardware software distinction as it relates to coding or as it relates to computation, how the two parts work together, how they communicate with each other, and how that might play out in terms of human, if there is such thing as human hardware and software, how that might connect.
Totally. Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's kind of a loaded question in some ways. The short version is I think the distinction is actually a lot more blurry than it might seem at face value. So like the naive kind of maybe like pop culture understanding of hardware versus software would be like the hardware is like the physical thing that I touch. I've got my computer and I open that box and inside the box there's things I can touch, right? And then the software would be like making that stuff do things. And that distinction is helpful, I think, as far as it goes, but software is really like layers and layers and layers on top of each other. I mean, we've had conversations about this, right? Where it's like, at the physical level, the hardware is doing all this stuff to kind of basically take information and translate it to other information based on its current state, So like if you've heard like the concept of like a state machine, the hardware at its most fundamental level is trying to say, okay, given my current state, based on some rules, I want to move into a new state. Right. And this will probably remind you a lot of what like Wolfram is talking about right now, right? He's thinking in terms of state machines like computers, right? And then the challenge is that like things are really hard to work with at that level. Right. Like, I don't want to have to think in terms of ones and zeros and stuff because that's like so granular. Right. And so you get like a very simple programming language on top of that that says, well, instead of thinking in terms of a bunch of ones and zeros, let me think in terms of like, I want to take a group of information and I want to move it from here to here, or I want to flip it, or I want to add it to this other group, right? And then you can kind of just keep building up from there. It's like I can take that super simple programming language and make another language on top of it that says, well, this group of information, combining it with this group, that's kind of like addition. So let me have a language here with a plus sign where I say this plus this. And now I can start to think more in terms of how I operate as a human being. And then you kind of keep building layers and layers on top of that until you get to these really, really abstract, but very more kind of human programming languages, right? And so that's kind of the way the bridge is working is like now with these really abstract languages, I can think more in English and more in like how I interact with the world, and that can get translated layer by layer back down to operations on this state machine, right? But the distinction there between like where does the hardware stop and the software end is like really blurry because like in some sense all of it is operations on it. Like it depends whether you want to think of it in a top-down versus a bottom-up way. Like from the bottom up, you could say it's all state machine. But from the top down, you could say, well, like, well, it's all movement in the world or something. Like I don't have a great way to put it, but does that make sense what I'm getting at so far?
I think I was following you up until you got to the fact that there's a blurry edge between the two. Because it seems just like common sense that the hardware is the box, the part that moves inside, and that the software is the part that makes it move. Or that, as you said, changes the state one way or another. I understand a very little bit about things like Ethernet and the seven levels. I mean, I do understand a little bit about some of that stuff because that's what my husband worked in years ago. So, and your distinction between bottom up and top down, I'm not quite clear on that. But I think I really like to explore that because I think that's part of what's going on here. But let me just run past you again the whole painting process that I go through, and let's figure out which part of that is hardware and which part of it is software.
Okay.
Because when I paint, let's say I have an idea, that would be the abstract thing. Which, like when you're coding, you have something that you're going to put into code, right? So I have this idea, and I have to figure out a way to make that idea become part of material reality. And in order for you to be able to see my idea, I could paint that idea with words. And, even that requires some bits of material reality. Even if it's spoken word, then at least there's air moving between us and something like that. But if the material reality I'm going to use is try to make it visually available to you, then I have to use either paint or pencil or clay or something like that, and I have to have some sort of a substrate, something to start with, something to put it on so that you can see it visually. So let's say I'm going to make a painting. I have a canvas will be my substrate. I'm going to have paint that I'm going to put on the canvas. Then I have to get it onto the canvas somehow. So in order to do that, I have to have some I can use my fingers, but then my fingers are my tools, or I can use a tool that is sensitive to my hand, like a brush or a pencil or something like that, to get to move the ink, the paint or the ink onto the canvas. So I have these tools and these materials, these physical resources that I'm using that I'm going to put on the canvas to try to represent that idea. And in order to make that happen, I have to continually look at the process as it's going along, step by step. and judge the how far I've gotten towards the vision. So each time I take a step, I have to look at that and say, okay, am I there yet? Well, no, I'm not. So I'm always looping back autoregressively to the original idea, or maybe I would say recursively, looping up here. Am I close? Not yet. So I need to do this. I need to make a change. Or sometimes I have to make a broad change in order to get back to the right direction. And that process continues until I finally come to maybe a halting state where I say, okay, I can't go any further. Maybe this isn't perfect, but it's the best I can do right now. So I'm going to stop here. And then maybe take a look at that and see how close did I get to the original vision. If I didn't get very close to the original vision, I'm going to try to build a new set of skills so that the next time I make this attempt, I can get closer. So it's that process, which I think is the same process that's happening with scientific investigation. I think it's the same process that we use day by day when we walk down the sidewalk, you know.
Right.
Am I in between the lines, or am I not in between the lines? I mean, it's not quite that static, but there is something that's guiding every decision we make as to whether or not it's accomplishing what's in our minds to bring it into material reality. So which part of that is hardware and which part of that is software? And it's okay to say things that aren't quite right. We'll
Yeah.
sort it out as we go.
Well, it's just like my mind is going in like a million different directions because like I've been changing my own ideas about this lately. Like the question is there's a lot there. Cause I think throughout my teens and 20s, I would have just said, well, this is the hardware and my thoughts are the software. And I would have just kind of left it that, right? And that's true, I guess. Like I don't, but I think let me just share two things. I don't know if this will make sense. Maybe it'll make sense as we go. In the art therapy world, they focus a lot on kind of the different ways we use our mind. And you could think of it as kind of there's a bottom to top and there's a left and right. That's kind of how they lay it out, right? And so they'll break it up into these six different components, three on the left, three on the right, the kind of base, like lizard brain or whatever, and then kind of the highest, like the most cognitive, and then kind of the middle layer, right? And the idea is that like let's say when you're in kind of the lower parts of your brain that are maybe closer to the hardware, so to speak. You're just dealing with the raw information. I feel stuff, the kinesthetics of it all. But then as you move higher and higher up to the top parts of the brain, you're dealing more with the cognition, the ideas, the bigger picture, the kind of fuller reflections of everything. And their whole angle on that in the art therapy world is they say, well, a healthy person is someone who is able to utilize all of that effectively and is able to fluidly move between those different zones when needed. And so a person that gets really, really stuck in the cognitive but like struggles to like handle raw information, that's the kind of person that's going to live up in the clouds in the world of ideas but really struggle to like dance and feel embodied, you know what I mean? And so therapy for that person in art therapy would be like, let's get you used to just moving around all these zones, And so I think that's one of the directions my mind goes thinking about this hardware software distinction is like, again, I struggle to see a clear distinction beyond just kind of the naive one, but maybe the naive one is legitimate, Another direction my mind goes with all this is kind of the work of like James Gibson on perception. I don't know how familiar you are with him, but
Yes, because we talked about him with Wolfgang Smith
yes.
substantially, and then also John Verveke has been very interested, and I think Jordan Peterson is also very interested in Gibson, but Verveke and Peterson are interested in Gibson's theory of affordances. Wolfgang Smith was much more interested in Gibson's theory of ecological perception. So, which one are you specifically talking about?
Probably more the ecological perception part. Just like where I go with all this, the reason I brought him up is that, like, in kind of the Enlightenment era, and especially since, the early days of psychology, we've had this notion that, like, we're getting raw data about the world, and then we're having to reconstruct an idea of it in our minds and then reflect on that idea so that we can then decide how to move in the world, right? And so you have this, like, that creates this distance between you and reality, because reality is just a bunch of kind of noise, and you're having to make sense of it yourself and then do something with it. But Gibson started off seeing the world that way, as most people did, and then he started to think, wait, there is no reconstruction process happening in the middle. Reality is directly affecting me. Which sounds kind of abstract, maybe, but when you really get it, it's a really kind of mind-blowing idea that, like, wait, there isn't this distance between me and the world, and I'm having to kind of construct it. It's happening to me, and I am literally directly perceiving the things that are available to me, and they are directly influencing me in the same way that the weather outside directly affects the barometer and the thermometer, right? The thermometer is not having to, like, reflect on the information it's receiving. It's just boom, the information is happening to it, right? And so that's true of us also, but also we're able to reflect as well. And I wonder if that's maybe part of the hardware software distinction, is like the hardware is like the thermometer, the software is like the reflections on what's happening.
Oh, super interesting. So the hardware has to do with the measurement problem, really.
Yes.
So Gibson actually went after this idea experimentally, and he determined, based on lots and lots and lots of research, which started when he was hired by the military to help them figure out how to get when a plane has to land on a aircraft carrier, it's a very precision move, and the aircraft carrier is moving at the same time that the plane is, but the plane is moving much faster than the aircraft carrier. How does that plane determine where the aircraft carrier is? And that was the problem that he was researching, but ultimately he came to the conclusion that there really is a there. And it's very difficult to try to explain in a few words here, because I'd have to go back and review all the notes. But Wolfgang Smith used to say that Gibson kind of affirmed for all of us that when we're looking at an apple, it's actually an apple, and it's actually red, and red is a thing, and it's not just a construct of our brains.
Correct.
And that is perplexing, because from the scientistic point of view, red is just a wavelength,
Right.
and how our mind perceives that wavelength. And so they do give us this idea that we're constantly constructing the world in front of us as we go.
And I think, as you brought up maybe before we started recording, like, C.S. Lewis's idea of transposition is really, really relevant here, right? Because I think that can serve as kind of the bridge between all this, where it's like the science world is really focused on, like, okay, if I draw a picture of mountains on a piece of paper, like that's representing something that's beyond the paper, right? But on the paper, it's just triangles, right? And so the scientist is kind of the one who's just saying, well, I'm only going to focus on what's on the flat paper, and all I see is triangles. It's like, well, yeah, because I mean, that's how you have to project onto that surface. That's the only option you have. But if you understand that there's something higher going on that's getting projected down to a lower dimension, then it's like, okay, it all makes sense. Like, yes, in one sense, it's triangles, but in another sense, it's much more than triangles. And I think the same thing is happening with like red and wavelength. It's like the kind of 2D flat projected version of what's going on there is, yes, we can measure what wavelength red is, and we can measure what wavelength green is, and those are different. But that's in some sense a kind of projected version of what's going on. You know, that's where heaven and earth meet, and like we don't have access to what's kind of above us, but it just seems kind of patently obvious that there are things happening above us and that we have access to this, right? But the whole scientific paradigm says, well, whether something's happening above or not, we're just going to look at what's available to us. And that's kind of like living on the 2D piece of paper and just saying, well, maybe there's something above, but we don't have access to that. So let's just live on the 2D piece of paper, and all I see is triangles. It's like, well, yeah, then that's all you're going to see. Sure.
But fundamentally, what you're saying is that without the actual mountains, there would be no triangles because the triangles represent something, and that something is more than the triangles, and the only way that we can represent it on a piece of paper is with triangles. So when I think about the way AI works, perhaps one of the reasons that it is like right now so very flexible and seemingly intelligent and fun to talk to, fun to explore ideas with, is that there is something bigger that it has tapped into, but not outside the linguistic system of humanity, but within the linguistic system of humanity, because we are always, in one sense or another, accessing that higher that's coming through our language and then producing the stories and the narratives and the poems and the scientific papers and everything else that's out there that's in the database that AI is using. That's something larger has already been transposed into human
Yes.
language. And therefore, when AI is exploring that space, it has access to those patterns.
Yes. Yeah, because like I think that's a great way to put it. It's like the books we write and the words we put on the internet, which is what AI has been trained with, or these LLMs have been trained with, is a very compact version of our experiences in the world, right? And so in the same way we were talking about the difference between the thermometer versus like the reflections, it's almost like the software we're running per se is like our self-reflections of the world, right? And then we kind of condense that down into language, into words, and then the AI has access to all that. But in some sense, that's almost kind of like saying, okay, I have all these experiences of mountains. I'm going to draw lots of pictures of mountains. And then the AI is the AI doesn't have access to the mountains. The AI just has access to the pictures of mountains, right? But even with all that, it's able to kind of take all that condensed information and do some stuff with it and go, well, I have lots of examples of mountains here, but it kind of just sees the triangles, right? But even by just making more triangles, it's able to make stuff that, yeah, that kind of looks like a mountain, you know? And it hasn't actually experienced the mountain. Because remember, we are actually ecologically experiencing the mountain. I'm not just reconstructing the mountain. I go to the mountain and I hike it, and all of its affordances are literally directly available to me. right? And that influences me. And I'm able to self-reflect on that. And I come up with words, I come up with pictures, I can do all kind of stuff that represents it as best I'm able to in this kind of transposed, projected, flat form. But that's all AI has access to, you know. And I think the transhumanists will go, well, soon AI is going to be, it's going to have robot bodies and it'll be able to go out there and it'll be able to hike the mountain itself. And it's like, yeah, but like the sensors you're going to put on that robot are so exponentially deficient in contrast to, I mean, we are just a whole extremely dense mass of like, it's hard to even put into words just how, like, if you want to use the computer analogy, we are like the way our neurons are hooked up and everything, and the amount of processing we do is just so absurdly exponentially higher than even a supercomputer, right? And that's not an exaggeration. I mean, it's like it's no comparison at all. And so, yeah, these creepy robots will be able to run up the mountain with a handful of sensors, but that's like a teeny tiny brain, right? And then that'll get hooked up to the LLM, which seems like a huge brain, right? But in some sense, that's just all the transposed pictures of mountains, just all the triangles, and it's gonna like, so the robot that can run up the mountain with its tiny amount of sensors is gonna look at the transposed stuff and map its like teeny tiny information gathering to that. And it's this sort of weird chimera of stuff that, like, yeah, that'll kind of work for some things, but that's not the same as what we are and what we're doing.
Yeah, so one of the things that I was trying to explore with Michael, and I don't think I approached it from a standpoint that made it coherent, so I'm going to try again with you is that so the LLM has access to this gigantic body of linguistic elements, I guess you would say, all the words and phrases and sentences and paragraphs that have been used, logical discussions and illogical discussions and emotional outbursts and all kinds of stuff is thrown in there.
Yes.
And in a sense, when we're talking, we have access to our own structure that's based on all the words and ideas and songs and stories and poems and everything and conversations that we've had in our lives. And that's all in me, so that when I start talking, I am filtering it through that as I'm trying to communicate what's in my mind to you. So that whole filtering process is going on. But I think that what's happening is that the linguistic system itself, and of course within each language it has its own linguistic system, that linguistic system itself is operating on a, I tried, it's very hard to use words with this, but some sort of matrix of possibilities that is the same matrix of possibilities, I think, that underlies the universe itself. It's like a scaffold of reality. And that scaffold of reality is, maybe you could call it a set of universal axioms, but they are not static, but they're dynamic because it's this constantly intersecting, interwoven scaffold of the elements and principles of design that are guiding how complexity and meaning manifest in the world. So that scaffolding of reality that, let's say, that's underneath physics is guiding quantum mechanics, whether there's balance or repetition or gradation or direction or vectors, all of those things are moving through this scaffold of reality, so that there are some limitations on what can happen, but those limitations are as few limitations as possible to provide the most amount of freedom so that the maximum meaning and beauty can be accomplished within this system. So I think there are like intrinsic properties of the universe that are related to this scaffold of reality, which is composed of the elements and principles of design. And I think that that same scaffold is what is kind of the bound of our linguistic system, which is what provides so much flexibility within a linguistic system as to what can be communicated. But there's an additional layer, just like in physics, there's an additional layer of physical laws. In the linguistic system, there's an additional layer of limitations of, like within English, we're very limited as to which letters can go together to make a word. And you don't become very conscious of this until you start playing something like Wordle. And you have to come up with five letter, you have to find the five letter word. And you discover very quickly that there are only certain combinations of letters that will make a five letter word. And there's a very tight guideline as to what letters go together and what letters don't go together. A only follows E in certain circumstances, and E only follows E in certain circumstances. And so there's that set of rules, and then there's it, but they're not like stated rules. I doubt very much you could put them into writing and say these are the rules, because there would be millions of these rules.
Right.
And then there's also the rules about what words can go together to make a phrase. Not every word can follow every other word. And that's part of what they're doing within the LLM, right? Is what are the probabilities of when that next word can show up? And then only certain phrases can go together to make a sentence. And oddly enough, only certain sentences can follow each other, because if you get one sentence following another that it's an incoherent idea, then it's not very useful, right? So there are these syntactic structures, semantic structures that are all part of what it takes to produce this linguistic system. But I think that fundamentally underneath it, what's kind of holding it up is this scaffold of reality.
Okay. Yeah, I think so. I just want to make sure I'm understanding kind of where you're going with that. Like, for you, what's exciting is that you can just kind of build a fence around a playground and then all kinds of play becomes available. And that's kind of happening in every arena because that's just how reality works. Like, fundamentally, reality is create some simple boundaries and then all kinds of stuff is available.
Yeah, although I'm not sure that I would call them boundaries so much as if you could imagine a playground that it's a really stupid
That
idea.
might not be the right metaphor if it's not.
Well, okay, but just think of a big net
Okay.
running through a playground, but not a regular net, but odd shaped pieces of big flexible coils running this way and that and intersecting at odd places, so that a child can slide down this net along the cords and never fall through the cracks, but just keep sliding in various ways all over this net. And there can be a lot of fun and creativity and everything happening within this net. But this net sort of keeps you within the playground, but still within a playground that is almost ultimately flexible. There's a lot of motion and interaction available, not like a static fence, but like a dynamic.
Yeah.
Somebody described once to me Indra's net, which is kind of an interesting idea. I don't think it's quite the same thing, but there is this idea of this. I think it's a maybe a Hindu idea or something. And at each intersection, there's a little jewel. And that when you look out over Indra's net, each jewel reflects every other jewel in the net. And it may be something like that, that each intersection. I could imagine that each particle in the universe is a particular intersection of a particular set of principles. So let's take the principle of harmony. You go from very harmonious to very inharmonious. There's a scale. And maybe some of those are more surprising than others. And so you have this scale, and the intersection of that harmony with maybe some kind of balance. But rather than being fully balanced, it's a little bit off balance. And so those two things are going to intersect at that place where it's slightly inharmonious and mostly balanced. But then that's also going to intersect with something that is very light, and another thing that is very that is at a certain point in the gradation between dark, between orange and blue, and at a certain location. So every particle in the universe also has a location, and it has a direction. And so every particle in the universe has a unique identifying, I would say, artistic fingerprint, like a stroke of paint.
And I guess that maps really well onto, all of the, like your art process, like you were talking about earlier, because then it's not just random, chaotic, raw information, and it's totally your burden to like gin up some meaning. It's like the meaning making process happens as part of sort of the play on that net. It's like, like you said, it's not exactly boundaries, but it's, yeah, there's not a good word, 'cause like boundaries and limitations are the word that's coming to mind, but that sounds like unnecessarily restrictive. It's not restriction, it's affordance. It's like this is like this these are the configurations that are allowing affordances, that are allowing things to happen.
Yes. And I think the other thing is you can produce a work of art that's just a bunch of random strokes. Even then, it's very difficult to be completely random. Very, I've tried. But if you're at all guided by beauty, or guided by completeness, or guided by some sense of truth, or even by the measurement of how close you are to some ideal, some idea of some sort, if you're at all guided by that, these naturally come into play. So over the millennia, artworks that draw people in are the ones that exhibit these principles. And that's how they've been discovered. People have spent time looking at all these paintings that have drawn people in and said, what is it that's drawing people? And that's how these principles have been codified. They've not been invented by man. They've been explored based on what has drawn people in, what is able to compose meaning and beauty that draws people in. And that is the set of principles that I think is the scaffold of reality, because we live in a world filled with meaning and beauty if we just open our eyes and look around.
And for me, this is, I think I'm now going into like therapy mode a little bit, or therapist mode a little bit, where I'm
I
thinking about,
need it.
no, I don't mean for you. I just
I'm
mean,
just teasing.
I just mean like for me, one of the big light bulbs has been like realizing that for hundreds of years, we've lived in this billiard ball universe, or we've thought about things in terms of like, it's all just random. It's all just chaos. And if any meaning seems to emerge from that, it's kind of just incidental. It's like, well, yes, but that's not real. Remember, it's not real. And it's like fundamentally what's happening there is like that means that like we are a culture who is has it's like we've been taken out to the playground and said, okay, go play, you know. And we're just kind of sitting there like, but the cars are just gonna drive on top of me. And it's like that kid needs to realize like that's not gonna happen, you know, like that is not the world you live in. You do live in a world where there's a lot of possibility, and those possibilities are surprising and unexpected. There is grief, there is death, there are things that go wrong. But there is so much affordance and so much possibility that actually allows meaning to be imbued in all of the raw stuff, you know? And so I get this really strong mental picture of like we are a culture of little kids on the playground who don't believe there's a fence around the playground, and we don't know how to play. And so we just kind of sit in place and talk about play, reflect on play, or say, there's no such thing as play. Play is just, you know, and it's like, it's just silly. It's like, we need to just stop. Like, hey, kid, just go play for a while and just go kind of feel that in your body and feel what that's like. And I think if we just kind of did that, we all kind of chill out and go, oh, yeah, okay. I don't know.
Well, so that's what Rafe Kelly is doing. He thinks that that's the way to bring people back. You familiar with Rafe Kelly's work? Oh, he's been in and around. I had him on one time as a preliminary to the conference in Olympia because those of us who were speaking at the conference also spoke to each other via Zoom in the weeks preceding the conference, so we would kind of get to know each other. So Rafe started this thing with he was really into parkour and discovered how it had helped him to develop as a human being. So he found a way to do parkour out in the woods, leaping from tree to tree and just learning how to extend his physical capacity. So he started leading retreats out into the woods to teach people how to do parkour in the woods. And he discovered that it was opening up all of these emotional areas of human life as well. And so he has expanded his whole it's not a ministry, it's just what would you call it? A program. He's expanded his program quite a bit and has just found it makes a tremendous difference in people's lives because once you learn to manage your own physical being in a way that you find that you can do things that you didn't even know were possible, and that there are all these affordances. Like when you're leaping from tree to tree, there are actually things that will catch you and to hold on to and that will help you to push off. And you know, all of that is the universe is a I can't remember what the phrase is that Dallas Willard uses, but he uses a word something like the when you discover that the universe is like a warm and loving place that you know that you can explore and experience instead of seeing it as a threatening non-entity, right?
Totally. No, that makes a lot of sense to me. I think that for me, that maps a lot onto what I was getting at with art therapy earlier, where it's like if you can learn to engage with what's there at the bottom level and at the top level and everything in between, then yeah, you're just able to engage with all the affordances, you know? Because so much of what therapy is about is just helping people realize, like, well, okay, this is an oversimplification. So much of my side of therapy, there's different camps, you know. I'm in a certain camp. I don't want to get into all that, but like my camp of therapy kind of sees things in terms of like, yeah, if you can see better the affordances that are actually available to you instead of getting trapped in one perspective, then you'll be able to just look at it and go, oh, okay, I'm not actually trapped. I just need to come at it from over here and I'm good, you know. And so yeah, I can totally see how Rafe's work is helping people do that kind of at the kinesthetic level. But once you can do it at that level, you can do it at the higher levels and the higher levels until you can do it for just your whole life. And recognize that you're not God. It's like there's a limit, I go this high and no higher, right? I think that's another, I mean, that's a whole nother conversation, but that's also part of, I think, what we're missing. It's almost like in a weird way, we reduced everything and made ourselves flat and reduced all the meaning. And then we kind of inverted everything and made ourselves God. And it's like both of those problems have to get solved. It's like we have to recognize we're not God, but also we're not flat. You know, we can,
Is
we can.
that part of why this whole movement of particularly men towards like weightlifting and physical fitness to kind of rebuild their lives is successful? I mean, I wonder if part of that, like weightlifting and everything, is to discover what your limits are and then to try to push through a little bit and a little bit and to learn that you can make incremental progress, but you're not God. You can't just do everything. You're limited by your physical strength and capacity, and you're limited by the instruments that you're using to improve that capacity. So we're just limited by reality in every way. And yet we can go beyond a little bit, beyond, beyond, beyond. And that's part of what it means to be human too.
I think there's a lot going on with the weightlifting thing. Because part of it is it's like it's not just the physical, like it's the physical limitations and the emotional and the social and the spiritual, all of it kind of together, right? Because like on one level, let's say the emotional level, it starts off as like, oh, I'm kind of chubby, I feel really embarrassed to be in the gym. And so it's kind of working through that shame and realizing like, oh, okay, I have a panic attack when I go to the gym, but I'm able to do it. I'm able to get something done and leave, and like that was terrible, but it didn't kill me. And the more experience you get, the more you work through that shame, and you realize, oh, I can exercise around people and it's no big deal. You're starting to, yeah, kind of expand. It's like you were stuck in this really narrow vision of what's possible for you, and now you've expanded. And so doing that on the emotional level and the social level, starting to realize like, oh, I'm really nervous to ask people for a spot, but you know, the first time you do it, you feel overwhelmed and it's embarrassing and whatever, but then you realize, oh, that was not that bad, and that guy was cool, and we actually had a, you know, pleasant conversation. And the more you do that, you're expanding. It's like the gym is like a playground. It's a microcosm of I'm doing the physical, I'm doing the emotional, I'm doing the spiritual, I'm doing the social, and it's all wrapped up together, you know. And you know. But I think,
I'd never thought about it on all those levels before. That's really interesting.
yeah. So I think a lot of, I mean, I don't think people go into it seeking all that. I think it's just like, oh, I want to look jacked or whatever. But like, it ends up becoming all of that, you know?
Well, that's the other thing, you know. Oh, I want to look jacked. We can have that idea. But the reality is so much different than just the idea. The idea by itself is completely meaningless. I joke a little bit, but it's just way too true of my life. I can look at my kitchen junk drawer and I can think, I can see it, how it would look if it was completely pristinely organized. I can see it, and then I'm sort of satisfied with that. And so I close the drawer and I go on and I do something else. And you know, you can say, oh, I want to look jacked. That's, you know, I got a goal. But if you don't make any movement towards the goal, you can kind of get to where you're satisfied with just the thought. And I think that also is a symptom of what has been done to us, of kind of flattening us and keeping us from interacting with reality. Because interacting with reality, it creates problems. It, you know, it's real, it's painful, it pushes back. Could we go back to this little discovery we made about how measurement is at the boundary between hardware and software? Do you remember when we came to that conclusion, and could you restate? I didn't take very good notes at that
No, you're
point.
fine. I think that came up when we were talking about Gibson.
Well, you were talking about the boundary between hardware and software is very nebulous.
Yeah, because I think, okay, I mean, so this could just be a consequence of how I think about things. And so, I mean, this may not be real. You know, this may just be me playing with my own metaphors, but like, I think of it as I am experiencing reality ecologically, right? It's hitting me. I am becoming aware of the affordances. My body's becoming aware of the affordances without me having to reflect on it at all. There's no middle layer of reflection, right? But then on top of that, I also have the ability to reflect on it, right? And so it's like, you know, I look at the cup and it's the information is coming into me, but even before I think about it, it's affecting me. Like my hand is able to kind of become aware in some sense that one affordance is this handle. Right. That happens before I do any reflection on it. That's kind of Gibson's claim, right? But then on top of that, I can also have memories of, oh, there was that one time where my hand, the handle of my mug broke. That's interesting. Or, you know, and so I wonder if what you're getting at, or what we're both getting at, is that there's kind of this interesting intersection of like meeting the middle where it's like the raw information is kind of like the ecological perception. But then my own mentalizations is my own kind of reflection on that. And that's where my agency lives, because then I can start to think about, okay, well, here's the affordances that are available to me. Let me reflect on what affordances I want to find relevant right now and which ones I want to act on and how I want to act on them. You know, because it's like maybe by default, like I never pick this thing up by the handle, I always pick it up by the edge like this, right? Because that's, for whatever reason, that's what I find relevant. That's probably a really complex process of like, well, the handle's really small. I think it's just kind of there for looks. It's not very functional. Like this for me feels, it fits my the size of my hand better.
But even that, when you first, the very first time you saw that cup, just the seeing of it, your hand probably formed up in a way that made it ready to hold that cup, because that's something that Peterson talks about often too, is that we don't see things primarily as objects. You don't look at it and say, oh, there's a cup. You look at it and there's a thing that will hold water. There's a thing that I can put things in. So you see it as a tool first before you see it as an object. And so things are in this kind of tool category. Now, that is something that I think AI is probably missing, is that aspect of categorizing things as tools before it sees them as words or as things. But that's just a thought that just came to me.
Yeah, no, that
I
makes
could
sense
be
to
wrong
me.
about that.
That makes sense to me in terms of like we were talking about, like the AI is not thinking in terms of affordances, right? Because I think that's that Gibson's idea of affordance is closely related to what you're talking about with the toolishness, I think. Like the toolishness is like, oh, I can do something with that because of the affordances that are available to me by nature of its being and my being. And our and the intersection of our beings, right? That's like the whole thing. But yeah, AI is not doing that. It has no, I mean, it's not it's experiencing affordances on the language level for sure, right? Like that you could say in one sense, like the whole corpus of the training data set, you know, it trains and trains and it builds this really, really big complex network of relationships between all the tokens, right? That network of relationships is its world of affordances, right? And so that's real in the same sense that my world of affordances is real. But like, I think we see AI wrongly if we don't understand what the nature of that world of affordances is in contrast to our own world of affordances. Make sense?
So in a sense, let's say that the AI world of affordance is that certain tokens have like little hooks on them in places that will hook on to the next affordance.
Yes.
That there's a variety of affordances that could attach to that, just like in a molecule, there are certain things that can attach to a molecule to make a chemical bond. And there are maybe more than one, but it's not infinite. There's a limited number of things that can attach to any given token, and those are the affordances of that token. Is that kind of what you mean?
Think so. And it's like, obviously, that by itself, that very narrow, limited world of affordances is able to do a tremendous amount. But I don't think that means that we're getting close to recreating ourselves. I think that's just a reflection of, yeah, the world is just exploding with affordances, even in this narrow sense. How much more than when you're fully engaging with the real world as it is? Like, I think our takeaway from all of this kind of like emergent effects of AI should be to glorify God and say, you've created such a beautiful, complex world of affordances that even this narrow, limited thing is able to do a tremendous amount. How much more than am I able to do? Or even my dog or a plant? Or, I mean, this is, there are affordances, right? Like, I can't just randomly move that over here. Right, I have to do it according to its constraints. I have to do that and then that, and now it's moved over there. But that affected other things because it had to, right? And that's how the whole world is, right? And that's not, I don't know. I don't see that as reducible to computation. It's relevant to computation.
Well, okay, so now we've hit another thing I want you to tell me about from a computer science standpoint. When you think of computation, what is the process that you're thinking of?
That's a good question. I've never thought very deeply about computation, but I think of it as reflecting on data or transforming data, let's say, taking data from one state and moving it to another state.
Can you give me a concrete example of what that is?
If I have two numbers and I'm adding them together, like let's say I have two numbers in binary, whatever, 0110101 plus 10111101. What I'm actually doing is just laying them on top of each other and just saying, okay, that plus that plus that plus that.
So you mean you can add two numbers together that way in binary, and that the result will be the same as adding those two numbers not in binary?
Yeah, I mean the binary is actually not relevant. I mean, it's the same process
No,
you learned
but
in school.
I'm sincerely curious about that. If I write out 9 in binary and then I write out 7 in binary and I add the two of them together in binary, will the resulting binary be equivalent to 16? Oh, cool.
Yeah, and that
That's
happens
really
in every
cool.
base. And so you can do that in base 2, 3, 4, whatever. Like it's, yeah, that's just how numbers work. But it's easy to think about it in binary. Well, it's easy for me to think about it because I'm a computer guy and I've been thinking in that way for 20
Yes,
years. But
okay.
it's like each step of that process is really small. It's just, this is either a 0, 1, this is either a 0, 1, and I'm going to do something down here with that. There might be carryover, like you learned arithmetic in school, right? And so for me, that's how I think about computation. Computation is a process. And so in that sense, I've got, my state machine is this digit, if this is a 0 and a 0, then I have 0 down here and there's no carryover. If this is a 1 and a 0, and I have 1 down here, no carryover. 0, 1, this is a 1, no carryover. 1, 1, now I put a 0 here and I carry a 1 over here, right? And so that's a small state machine for adding one column of that binary number. And now I just repeat that same process for the whole thing, and now I've got my whole result, right?
So you have a little rule,
Mm-hmm.
And then you execute the rule over and over and over again, and then you get a result. So, but you said, you when we started, you said, but that's not computation. I can't remember what it was you were saying was not computation. I for some reason I'm very fascinated where this line is between computation and what it is that I do as an artist, or the thing that Glenn and I have wrestled to the ground, to the mat many times, is this idea of composing a piece of music. Because this would not be true of every composition, but the old urban legend was that Mozart would sort of get a symphony in his mind as a completed thing in his mind. So he could hear this symphony playing in his mind. But then, in order to make it possible for someone else to play it, he has to break it down into all the various instruments and then arrange what each instrument is going to be playing, what their part is, and then writing that out on music staff paper, where the notes are, each note as it goes, and then distributing that to the various players. And then each player takes his piece of music and he plays his notes when they're supposed to happen. But then when the whole symphony comes together and all the players are playing their parts at the appropriate time, the symphony is recreated in its majesty. So you have a completed symphony in his mind, and then you have a completed symphony in the world. But to get there, it seems like it's some sort of computational process. Or his process is almost like coding. He's encoding that bigger picture into smaller bits, and then each instrument is playing those notes. There's a human intersect between the notes and the resulting sound that's coming out, and that human instrument obviously has some variability, but still they're just playing the notes that are on the piece of paper. So is that computation or is that not computation?
Yeah, I think so. I think like tell me if this makes sense. Like, are you familiar with like squaring the circle and that sort of thing?
Well, I know they say you can't square the circle, but I mean, you can stick a square inside of a circle, you can stick a square outside of a circle,
Yeah.
but
Well, let me use a slightly different analogy then. Like, imagine a circle and you've like inscribed a triangle in it, right? You've got some of the area, but you've also got this outer edge that's not accounted for, right? Well, then I could take that triangle and I could like make it a square. Now it's like, okay, I've gotten a little bit closer to the circle, and I can make that a pentagon and then a hexagon. I could keep inscribing a more complex shape within that, and I'm getting closer and closer to the circle, but I'm never going to get there. I can do that infinitely many times, and I'll get closer and closer, but I'll never get to the circle, right? I think that's how I view the difference between the world and computation. Like, I see the world as the circle, and I see computation as the process of trying to get iteratively closer and closer and closer to the circle. You can get very close. You can get close enough to where, by looking at it, you're like, yeah, that's pretty much the same thing, and those are going to pretty much do the same thing, right? And that's kind of how I think maybe I view what we're talking about. It's like the musician, the Mozart, the symphony comes flooding at him somehow, and he's like, okay, I have this circle and I want to try my best to represent it. So he's going to try to take the triangle and make it a square, make it a pen. He's going to do this as many times as he can till he's satisfied. Like you said earlier, it's never going to be perfect. You can never get there. But he can say, okay, I've done this enough to where it's close enough. And then that can be handed to someone. That's kind of the transposition process, maybe. And that can be handed to someone and they can do that. And it's like altogether, it's like, yeah, we've recreated in the world something very, very approximately like what was in your mind. It's maybe
That's
not
a
completely.
brilliant analogy. That's exactly what it is. Because no matter how great that symphony is, it will never be as perfect as it was in his mind at the beginning.
Right.
Which is something I discovered about painting too, is that first image or thought that you have is perfect in its conception. But there's no way to bring perfection into material reality. So the best you can do is a continuing iterative process of getting closer, getting closer, getting closer.
Yeah, I've never really been an artist per se, but and as a kid, I spent a lot of time programming, but I was doing it maybe in an artist's mindset, so to speak. Like, I liked making little games and little toys that you could play with, stuff that would like shoot little fireworks at the mouse and explode, and it always felt like that. It was like I have this really powerful, beautiful vision that evokes a lot of feeling in me. And I would try my best to make something that would help someone get a little glimpse of that feeling or a little glimpse of that experience. But it was, I could always tell this is not all the way there. I'd show it to people and they'd be like, oh yeah, that's cool, And I made a few kind of bigger video games that I published and people enjoy the experience, but they're not having quite the same feeling I had. I got my I transcribed the circle as best I could, but it wasn't all the way there, And I find that now I've got an idea for something I want to make right now, like a game, and I'm just like, I'm in that process now. This is kind of a bigger idea, and so it's a lot slower to start. I'm maybe two steps in. It's maybe a pentagon at this point, But I need a few hundred more steps before it's even close to being something. But yeah, it's like it's already there. It's like it's I'm not just creating it from nothing. I'm trying to, like, I can ask questions about it and go, is it more like this, more like that? And I just know, it's more like that. I'm discovering what it is. I'm accessing it. I'm asking questions of it and bringing it into being, But that process is nothing like what the materialist would tell me it is. The materialist is like, well, there's just neurons firing around, and it's like, ugh, you missed the whole thing.
Well, I think that there's two things. One is that I think that that whole thing of never being able to quite get there is our gift. It's a gift that is given to us. I mean, it's a gift that we receive because what that does is it always keeps the goal out in front of you so that you always have something to work towards so that you're continually striving, and that striving is showing you where the missing links are, and it's showing you what path to take in order to develop the skills or to gain the resources that are needed to accomplish that vision. And then when you get there, now your vision is out a few steps in front of you. Now you have a bigger picture of what you'd like to convey to people. And now you still don't have the skills to do that new bigger picture. So your vision is always outrunning your skill. And I think, although to us it's frustrating, it's actually a gift, because if we didn't have that thing pushing us out into the future, we'd still be living in the caves, you know? And so that's one thing. And now I forgot what the other thing was. But you were talking about.
I was starting to rant about materialism, but it's probably good that you stopped me.
Oh, well. But it also is true that we have material limitations. And oh, I know what I was going to say. The other thing about that picture of how we grow in knowledge, I think the one who has put it into common language the best is Esther Meek. She
Yes.
was working off of Michael Polanyi's ideas, but Esther sort of brought it into, and she's never as out there with it as I am, but I will take Esther's idea and put it out there. And for me, what Esther's idea is saying is that knowledge is an infinite pool that we're drawn towards, and that at the same time we're drawn towards some aspect of knowledge. Knowledge is reaching out to us and saying, here's a gift, follow this thread. And so we're like, whatever the knowledge is, let's say if I wanted to learn how to, one of the examples she uses, I want to learn how to take care of my rose bush. My rose bush is, at the same time I'm wanting to learn how to care for the rose is speaking back to me, here's what I need. Here's what helps me not, maybe the rose wilts. Oh dear, I think it's telling me it needs water, And so the it's always reaching, the affordances are always reaching back to us and saying, here's the way. And then we're simultaneously going towards it. So in a way, you have to have a relationship of love with the thing that you're seeking to know. And at the same time, you are developing that relationship of love with the thing that you're seeking to know, that is offering love to you. In fact, that offering of love is probably precedes your interest in the thing. So knowledge is always reaching out to us with a gift of love, and then we're moving towards it. So that's what. When the very first time I talked to Paul Vanderclay, like 6 years ago, on my conversation with him, was before I'd ever read Esther Meek or anything or had any language to use about it. But I told him, it seems to me that the universe is composed with an infinite amount of knowledge, and that it's just a place where we can go swimming. You can go swimming towards physics or towards biology or towards chemistry or towards art or whatever. We're swimming in this infinite sea of knowledge, and we just get to capture some of it and bring it back in and play with it. And in science, they've developed the scientific method for exploring that, but that's a very limited segment of what's available to us, right?
Well, and it's like and again, this comes back to kind of the therapist part of me, but I start thinking, okay, we've become so fixated on trying to understand how things work. We've with Gödel's incompleteness theorem and the measurement problem and all this stuff, we've kind of hit the boundaries of that and realized, like, okay, there's never going to be a complete formalized system of understanding. But we've gotten pretty far with some arenas, right? But also, again, it's like the kid on the playground who's just like been taken out to play. It's like, okay, it's recess. You got an hour to play in the playground. And the kid just sits there in the dirt, just kind of thinking about play. At some point, it's like, man, kid, get up, go play. Like, that's what we're here for, you know? And I feel this strong feeling that we're a culture of little kids who just have stopped playing and are just thinking about play. It's like, that's fine. That makes sense to do sometimes. Like, if you got a group of kids and they're trying to play tag, but they're not in agreement about the rules, it might make sense to stop and do kind of like a meta conversation. Like, okay, wait, how are we playing right now? What's the rule? But that the point of that is to get on the same page so that you can go back to playing, right? But it's almost like the Enlightenment was us looking up at the stars and going, wait, things might not be how we thought they were. And it's like we've stopped. And then we just stayed stopped. And it's like, okay, I think we've learned enough at this point. Like, we don't have to keep doing that. We can get back into the mode of like, okay, cool. So our intuitions are really good most of the time, but there's some times where our intuitions are wrong. We've got to rethink and kind of see the bigger picture. I think that should be the takeaway from the Enlightenment. But I think we should go back to playing and recognizing, and what I mean by that is like recognizing, like, what are we actually here for? Like, what is our purpose here? I don't, whatever. I mean, people, everyone likes to go all existential with that, but like it's obvious. It's right in front of you, And I think as a Christian, I'm just like, I think it's self-evident if you're not trying too hard and overthinking it. It's like, I don't know. I think Jesus laid that out like super beautifully. I'm like, okay, let's just go implement what he said,
And do you think that has to do with play?
I do. I mean, I think about it often as like an analogy I use for myself and like with friends when I'm talking about this stuff is like I hang out at the dog park a lot. You know, I've got a really active dog who's just social and whatever. And so like I go to the dog park and the point of us all being there is to get energy out with our dogs, you know. But we also like being around the dogs and watching them play. And then, you know, it's an eclectic mix of people, you know, who different politics, different socioeconomic, whatever going on. But as long as the dogs are playing well, then we can kind of chill out and we'll bring our lawn chairs and talk and goof off. And it's a really kind of tight-knit community, you know. But all of that is available because we have some structure, right? If the dogs were just fighting and tearing each other apart, we wouldn't be able to do that. And so the way I think about it as it relates to my Christianity is, okay, sometimes people there really annoy me or say something offensive to me. How should I respond? Should I just tear the fences down and put napalm all over the dog park and burn it down? No. You know, should I hold a grudge? No. I should probably talk to that person and have an honest conversation with them, but it should be for the sake of getting to some resolution and reconciliation so that we can go back to enjoying the dog park and playing with each other. You know what I mean? Like, to me, ultimately, that's what Jesus is doing and getting at. And he's showing that the only way ultimately to achieve that is to die to self, because there are going to be times where things can't be reconciled and one party is just going to insist on killing the other. And so at some point, someone has to just say, okay, well, do it. You know, I'm okay. And that's you know, unbearably hard to accept, you know, but that is the message, right?
But the reason I asked you about the play is because next week I'm talking with Chris Green. And he was one of the guys that was one of the speakers at the Olympia conference. And so I got to know him a little bit. Really wonderful. I think he's a pastor. He's also a theologian and a philosopher and a professor, I think. And he sent me all these very difficult things to read in preparation because I am not a theologian or a philosopher or anything. One of the things he sent me is Maximus on the Creation as Incarnation, which is by Jordan Daniel Wood. And another one is the Ambigua 71, which I think is Maximus the Confessor speaking about something written by Gregory of Nazianzus. And the Ambigua 71 is about the God who plays.
Interesting. Do you have you started it? Have you read
Yes,
it?
I read it. Yeah. Here's a quote from it. Which maintains an equal distance from the extremes on account of its fluid and mutable state of rest, a flowing that, and he's talking about the world, I think, a flowing that remains at rest, a state of rest that is forever flowing, perpetual dynamics that are stable. So looking at this paradox of how can something be always flowing but always at rest? How can there be perpetual dynamics and yet have it be stable? And I think that's exactly what you're talking about when you're describing the playground. That in order for th that there has to be some interface between those two things, and the interface between is what Jesus taught us. The only way to be always flowing and always at rest is to abide in him, and the only way to have perpetual dynamics that are stable is to have this, I don't know what you would call it, a steam valve, sort of,
Exactly.
right? The submission, the obedience, the recognition of the anomaly as a gift, the recognition of how to abide in him in the midst of chaos and difficulty and everything. That's kind of the steam valve that is between the perpetual dynamics and the stable rest. And he says that game playing is not development, but flow. The good is beyond all being. The formless is form producing. Neither being nor non-being, neither playful nor prudent. And then he goes on into the second contemplation. There's four contemplations, or three contemplations. There's four sections. The third contemplation, he talks about the things that are present and visible. Those things that are present and visible are unstable and mutable and without a solid foundation. And then there are things that properly and truly exist. Those are the divine and archetypal realities. So if we put all of our weight and our trust in the things that are present and visible, we're at a place that does not have a solid foundation. But if we put our weight and our trust in the things that properly and truly exist, those are the divine and archetypal realities. And I think the shape of that divine and archetypal reality is that which produces beauty, which is the elements and principles of design. So maybe that's a good place to wrap up for today, unless you want to have a little final word.
I don't think so. That's good to me. I mean, I was going to ask you, I don't know. I have a question I don't know how to formulate, but it's about beauty. I don't know if it's even worth asking.
Well, ask it and we'll see.
I mean, it's something like, what is beauty? Or why is beauty beauty? Something like that.
Well, I mean, that's the question of the ages, isn't it? But if I take as my ultimate framework that Christ is a representation to us of beauty, I mean, this is what got me thinking about this in the beginning when I've wrestled with this thing about these principles for going on 25 years now. And it was thinking about Christ being the ultimate reality. Then, as you were saying, if we think of the universe as this place that ultimately, if we are in Him, we're in a place of complete safety. And what does that mean about beauty? I don't know. Sevilla and I have talked at some length about the idea of quality, and is that the same thing as beauty? I don't know. Like Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Excuse me. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. He talks about this idea of when you're fixing a motorcycle, you come to a place where something just drops into place and it just works. And at that moment, you know that is quality. You could jam it into place and still it would work, it would function, but it's not the same thing as when everything just falls into place and works the way it's supposed to work. That is quality. And Pirsig's idea in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance is that drive for quality, or that is it something that we're driving towards, or is it something that's drawing us upward? That
Yeah.
is what he says shapes the universe, this drawing upward of quality.
Yeah.
And I think that's the same idea as this idea of the loving relationship that we have with knowing. So, this all goes into this whole framework of Peterson's idea of the order and the chaos lining up with the known and the unknown. And then in between the known and the unknown is the knower. And in Peterson's picture, the line between order and chaos in the yin yang symbol That is the line on which archetypal Christ is transforming the chaos into the order in a dynamic stability, you
Right.
could say, right? So, there is beauty in chaos. There is beauty in order, but both can also be not beautiful. So it's understanding when you find the beauty in the chaos, how do you recognize, if you fall into chaos, how do you recognize that which is beautiful in the chaos and that which isn't? And for me, when I fall into chaos, the only way I can tell what's of value there to bring back with me is if I just offer the whole thing up to Christ and say, I'm lost here. I'm suffering. I'm in pain. I don't know what to hold on to here. But if there's something you want to teach me or something you want to give me in this situation, then I'll take what you offer me. So ultimately, I think it has to be Christ that is the ultimate beauty.
That makes sense. I think my takeaway from that is, yeah, I'm kind of asking the wrong question in a sense. If I'm trying to, it's almost like I'm doing the scientist thing of trying to understand how it all works. Trying to, instead of engaging with beauty, I'm trying to stop like the kid on the playground. Like, what is play? What is beauty? You know, and it's like, in some sense, I think that's the wrong approach. It's like, just live, just experience, just engage with it. You'll get closer, you'll learn more. Yeah, like we love because he first loved us. Like you have to assume that it's there to start with, right?
Well, and that's, I think that's the approach that DC Schindler takes because he talks a lot about beauty. He puts love and beauty kind of in the same space, which sometimes makes sense to me, sometimes doesn't. But anyway, he puts them in the same space. And he talks about that when you look at a beautiful painting, say, or a beautiful sunset, it is being taken up into you, but at the same time you feel like you're being taken up into it. You're captivated by this sunrise or you're captivated by this beautiful painting, but at the same time you're taking that up into yourself and you're being changed, transformed within by that beauty. So again, it's this reciprocal thing, right? And maybe the beauty reaching out to us is the love coming first to us, and then we love back. So it's that reciprocal thing. So we just need to explore and experience beauty. And I think from what you were saying earlier about the dog park as an analogy, let's say, or just anything that we do in life, when we receive something with thankfulness, it becomes much more beautiful than it is if we don't receive it with thankfulness. So we can enrich and fill our lives with beauty the more we move towards gratitude, I think. I know I'm grateful for your friendship.
Thank you. I'm grateful for yours too. I was thinking during this, like, man, like in the same way that I keep using these analogies of the playground and the dog park and stuff, like this feels similar to me where it's like we're kind of meeting in the middle with some idea space stuff coming from different directions. But it's, yeah, it's fun. It's encouraging, you know.
Yeah, well, I've missed you while you've been working on your graduate degree, but kudos, kudos, you finished.
Thank you. I am so glad to be done. I got real tired of writing papers and it was all good. I learned a tremendous amount. I was forced to confront a lot of the boundaries of my thinking, you know what I mean? And integrate a lot of new stuff. But yes, I'm glad to be done. Glad to have time again.
Very cool. Well, I hope we can do this again soon. I've
Yeah.
thoroughly enjoyed it and take care. But by the way, my birthday is Saturday.
Okay.
So we have big plans to go out for dinner with my daughter and granddaughter. And
What kind of place do you go to for that?
well, there's a new restaurant in town, and we went there once for just a quick snack at lunch, and it's so beautiful. It's called RH Rooftop.
Okay.
So the RH stands for Restoration Hardware. So Restoration Hardware built a new store at one of our malls, at Stanford Mall. And the top story is got a beautiful glass roof. So the whole thing is glass. Wall-to-wall mirror, I mean wall-to-wall windows and a glass roof. And then there's kind of balconies out around, so there's outdoor seating as well. I don't know, it never gets warm enough at night here to eat outside, but so I don't know whether it will be inside or outside, but it's a beautiful environment. And I'm very excited about having dinner there. I don't even care what the food tastes like, honestly.
All right.
But I do think the food is pretty nice. And then, of course, it's Restoration Hardware. So all the furnishings are from Restoration Hardware. So it's very kind of, deluxe furnishings. And
That sounds really good.
it's my big 7-7. So I've got to celebrate
Yeah.
every year that I'm still here. My father died when he was 72, and my mother died when she was 74. They were 2 years apart, and they died 4 weeks apart. So every year I've had since 74, I have felt like it's a gift, and I need to just keep enjoying all of them. So good talking to you. Have a wonderful week, and can't wait to publish this and see what people think.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks,
Thanks
Karen.
a lot. Bye
All
bye.
right.